Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, coming to you live from Istanbul, Turkey. This is the episode of the 4th of February 2021. February is still looking as bleak on COVID-19 restrictions, unfortunately. In Europe, many countries are now restricting all travel from non-EU destinations, which is unprecedented in itself. Let's see if I'll get stuck anywhere, but as long as I have my microphone with me, you'll still get to hear from me every Thursday here on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. My guest this week is Ryan Karana. Ryan works as an analytics professional and AI policy researcher in Toronto, Canada. His writings on technology issues have appeared in The Telegraph, National Review, American Conservative, Toronto Star, and numerous other publications. We will be talking about geoblocking and what exactly it is that we can do to stop it. Geoblocking is the fact that you cannot access streaming content depending on the country you're in, or that you cannot purchase certain goods based on your location. Also in this episode, the EU is cracking down on red meat, the Czech Republic practices food nationalism, and the veggie burger is still under fire. So let's get started. The EU's leaked beating cancer plan reveals that changes are to be made about how we deal with red meat. In last week's episode, we already talked to Michael Landl from the World Vapers Alliance to learn more about how vaping will be affected. But the European Commission points out red meat is also a factor when trying to reduce cancer risks. So let me stress this before anyone gets the wrong idea here. That is not true. The studies we currently have that establish a link between red meat consumption and increased cancer risks only establish correlation and not causation. In 2019, a study in the International Journal of Cancer and in the International Journal of Epidemiology found links that were reported in mainstream news outlets. Here's an example from the UK with ITV News.
The researchers compared people who ate around 76 grams of red or processed meat a day, equivalent to about 3 rashers of bacon, with those who averaged 21 grams a day, about 1 rasher, and found their risk of bowel cancer was 20% higher. That risk went up by around 20% with each extra 25 grams of meat they ate. Not the best news for butchers.
We've been eating meat for thousands of years, and I think if you eat things in moderation and not overeat, then it's good.
And he has a point. 6 out of 100 of us will get bowel cancer regardless of what we eat. According to the new study, if we all ate the equivalent of a bacon sandwich every day, you get 1 extra case of bowel cancer out of 100. Significant, but modest.
I think we need to invest more efforts into understanding nutrition science, because one thing we learn is that it is really hard to establish control groups. Think about it in this way. You couldn't experiment with 100 patients by making them only eat one thing for 25 years and then test for their health developments. That is just not possible, so you often rely on questionnaires. Here's Dr. Aaron Carroll from the Healthcare Triage News explaining some of the problems with these studies.
Red meat for poultry, they claim, may cut women's risk of invasive breast cancer by more than a quarter, by 28% to be exact. I don't even know where to start. Maybe start with the fact that all participants were women with a family history of breast cancer. This population probably isn't the best place to start when trying to understand the general relationship between food and breast cancer, since there's likely a genetic component overwhelming everything else. Or maybe start with the fact that all data regarding type and amount of meat consumption were collected from a food frequency questionnaire administered one time. One time. Or maybe start with the fact that the more than a quarter risk decrease reported by the study represents the relative risk decrease. What's the absolute risk decrease? About 0.01%. And thanks to Just Says Risk for figuring that out on Twitter.
Here we need to understand the difference between relative risk and absolute risk. Relative risks evaluate the risk in comparison with different groups, while absolute risk is the one you're personally interested in. Let's give an example. Say the absolute risk of developing a disease is 4 in 100 people who don't eat gummy bears. Say the relative risk of the disease is increased by 50% in people who eat gummy bears. The 50% relates to the 4, so the absolute increase in the risk is 50% of 4, which is 2. So the absolute risk of gummy bear eaters developing this disease is now 6 in 100. So when you read the risk is 50% higher, you're getting the wrong idea. Because what you think is that now you're twice as likely to get this disease than you were before this study came out, when in reality, that is relative to your group behavior. With this whole red meat bashing that's happening, I remember being on TRT World in a debate back in 2018 on a panel with Dr. Springman from Oxford University, a researcher who is calling for a tax on red meat. Here's an excerpt from that.
We've tried this before. Denmark tried this in 2011 with a tax on saturated fat of more than 2.3%. And what we saw is that the same parliamentary majority that introduced it abolished the tax 15 months later because it did not work. The claim is that it was reduced by 10 to 15%, but it wasn't. The actual reduction was 0.9% because people stockpiled by going to Germany and stockpiled for months before the tax was introduced. And so the actual reduction was 0.9%.
Cross a border to drive into another country to save 10% off a can of corned beef?
Yes, the evidence actually shows that, and the consumer behavior shows that. And lastly, what I also want to say is what people did is they downgraded in quality. So people kept their fat consumption, but downgraded on the price. So they bought the cheaper brands in order to keep the same consumption. So just assuming that if people get rid of red meat multiple times a week, they will just stop their consumption of the same nutrients altogether. That's not true. We all know this. We come home from a trip, there's nothing in the fridge, we take the first thing we find. Maybe we eat candy if we don't have meat there.
Now, the EU isn't saying in this beating cancer plan that we need to tax red meat, even though I do see a movement that is more and more prone to endorse this type of measure. But it wants to stop subsidizing everything to do with red meat marketing. Now, I'm a big fan of stopping to subsidize anything, but I also care about the reasoning for it. I think it won't stop at this measure, and we'll need to talk about this more in the future. In other news then, the Czech Republic is the next country in line to try out food nationalism. A new law passed by the Czech Parliament, which still needs to be approved by the Senate, would require that supermarkets with a retail surface of more than 400 square meters would need to have at least 55% of their agricultural products, like meat, fruit, or vegetables, from the local Czech market. This would come into effect next year and be bumped up to 73% in 2028. This is at odds with the EU single market, by the way, which requires all member states to treat products equally. But it isn't the first time similar rules have been suggested or implemented. At the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, Austria, France, Portugal, and Bulgaria had similar ideas, many of them challenged by the European Commission. Here's a statement from a Commission spokesperson on this issue from back in May 2020.
And when it comes to different calls from different member states or in different places that we hear about the need to consume local agri-food products, it should be noted that these calls were made even though no enduring supply problems or food shortages or sustained increases in food prices have been observed in Europe since the outbreak of the current crisis. And the commissioner addressed this issue on several occasions, notably in an exchange with the European Parliament, where he said that shortening supply chains is indeed more sustainable. But he also stressed that the integrity of the EU's single market should be respected. And if and when this integrity is put at stake or questioned, the commission will take action.
I agree that due to single market rules, countries should not discriminate between products. Now, if supermarkets want to make a 100% local selection, that is their prerogative. And consumers who want this kind of selection will find it. But it's unfair for governments to be the arbiter here. When I used to spend more time in Brussels, I would sometimes go to a local Asian supermarket, which I assume was bigger than 400 square meters, I think, with a wide selection of Thai, Chinese, or Japanese products, actually. Such rules would not allow for these stores to exist, and I think that's terribly unfair. Also, by the way, if you know the Czech Republic and its politics a bit, you'll know that Prime Minister Andrej Babiš, his businesses are heavily involved in Czech agricultural production. So to me, there also seems to be a vested interest in the government to promote local food, outside of any environmental considerations. In other news then, the veggie burger war is far from being over. Back in October, the European Parliament had faced a showdown over so-called food denominations. Here's Euronews reporting from back in October.
When is a burger a burger? Should a sausage ever be allowed to be meat-free? And what about a vegan smoked salmon? Is that even a thing? Well, a battle is raging over whether vegan burgers should instead be discs, or sausages rebranded as fingers. with MEPs to vote on whether to limit the use of words such as steak, sausage and burger to meat products, something the farming industry has been campaigning for.
For that nutritional value point of view also, we need to make a difference between the products. And meat is certainly different in its nutritional value than the meat replacements.
In the end, the European Parliament rejected amendments that would ban these denominations for meat-imitating products, but allowed for restrictions when it comes to milk products. But in the reform of the Common Agricultural Policy, CAP, changes can still be made. And we still don't know whether a veggie burger ban might still be incoming. I think it's silly that we're having this debate in the first place. As you know, I'm happy to defend meat production against those who want to restrict consumers from eating it. But I think it's bad public affairs to work to try and sabotage alternative meat-imitating products, such as plant-based burgers. To each their own, consumers should be allowed to choose which products they consume. And I think they're smart enough to realize that a veggie burger does not contain meat. In any way, it's now time to move to the interview of this week. My guest is Ryan Kurana, an analytics professional and AI policy researcher in Toronto, Canada. We're talking about geo-blocking, and I'm trying to find out why streaming services don't make their content available in every market, and what can be done to solve this issue.
Typically, one of the reasons why they choose to geo-block is because of the different rights holders for distributing content, especially for music and video content. It's actually quite complicated to get the rights to distribute it everywhere. Typically, a producer sells the content to a distributor, and the distributor makes a lot of different arrangements for how to get it to people depending on the location to bring the most money in. And so they have different dealings with different services depending on which country they're in. For example, there's a lot of things in the United States that have exclusive contracts with Hulu, but Hulu is not a company outside of the US. And so those same distributors will make a contract with a different streaming company. And so these local specific contracts mean that they can't show all the content everywhere, even though they technically on the back end have the access to that content. So they can distribute it legally, they're not able to.
So when I use a virtual private network, for instance, I can circumvent at least some of it on some platforms. That is when I connect to a proxy server in whatever country I want to access that content. Is that a loophole or is that endorsed by these services? Is that a way that it should be done? Or
in many ways, a lot of the rights holders don't want to allow VPNs to work on these streaming services. So the you kind of got right to it. So the streaming service locates you based on your IP address and it pings and it looks at where you are. And a VPN basically shuffles it to somewhere else. But a lot of that is hiding. And so streaming services do invest money into being able to identify who's using a VPN and then go back from that to where you originally are. It is something that they do. I wouldn't say they necessarily do it for their own benefit. They do it because it makes them have a better bargaining position with people who publish content. Because the more that they can rely on them to respect their copyright, the more the streaming service has the ability to attract these people. Now, is that good for the end user? Probably not, because rights are so complicatedly distributed across these different places.
Why do these rights have to be in that geographical location in the first place? That's what I don't quite understand. If I make an agreement, you know, if I buy the service of a streaming service that is located outside of my country in the United States, why should I not be able to have the exact same content that I can access? Why is that location based?
It has to do with the fact that there's different jurisdictions on copyright law globally. Each place has its own conception of who owns the rights and who's allowed to distribute. And due to that, a lot of companies, so let's say you're a production company, you finished making a movie, the way you sell to a distributor, those distributors want exclusive contracts because they have better deals with, let's say, movie theaters in a certain place, which was traditionally the case, or they had better marketing for a certain type of online or DVD channel. And so these distributors would have different regional rights holdings, and they were often competitive globally because there was a lot of local knowledge needed to market a film effectively, et cetera, et cetera. Those kinds of archaic systems of rights probably are less important right now because streaming is naturally global. You don't actually have to have those really customized local marketing and knowledge base that was required for people that were going physically to movie theaters and making a deal to show a movie. But the way that the right system works is still very much in that more making a local deal, doing that kind of marketing legwork. And as a result, the rights holders are very complicated to find.
In the European Union, there's even these rules for streaming services that want to create quotas for how much local content has to be on a streaming network. It's, I think it's up to 30% that needs to be local, even though I don't think that's possibly very very easy for Luxembourg, my small country of origin. But there seems to be mixed messaging there, because on one hand, we want these local contents to be created. On the other hand, the EU says also that geo-blocking is evil and we shouldn't have it whatsoever. How exactly could countries coordinate in order to solve this problem?
Yeah, it's one of the complicated things about media distribution. It's one of the reasons why a lot of these legacy complexities and rights exist. So in a lot of countries, you do have requirements for certain kinds of domestically produced content to be shown. And that's one of the reasons why a distributor showing a foreign content needed to have that kind of knowledge to sell it well. When you're trying to get rid of geo-blocking to say that these rights are more unified, we're going to make it borderless, which does make sense given the digital single market objective, making these rights more systematized across all these places, don't have them as localized. When you have that quota that's 30% for a national distribution, that comes into conflict. So right now, if you look across the EU, you have a lot of countries that get nowhere near the entire amount of content available. Like a country like Greece has access to about 1% of all the European available titles, whereas a country like Germany gets 50% of all the available titles. And no one has 100% because they're all distributed in ways that allow for this local content and changes. If you want everything from everyone to be available to everyone, you can't really have a 30% quota. It's a contradictory goal. But I think the idea is that you can either do it at an EU-wide level, that we're saying that the block is producing local content. So if it doesn't matter if it's Luxembourgish or Greek or German films, that has to be a significant portion compared to just American or foreign films. But if you're doing it locally, it can't be quota. It has to be, it can't be quota by percent. It has to be quota by amount of films. You have to say that we want this many films from our country a year picked up. That's the only way to make it logical, so that a production and distribution company can, in fact, get them placed on the streaming service.
What about an international solution, an international standard, and then I have my local Amazon Prime, or I pay extra, and then I have an international standard from which I can, you know, stream and download everything across the world. Would that be possible?
It would require a lot of copyright coordination, because as I said, it's not just that we have content that we're choosing not to show you. It's we have contents that we're not partnered with this specific distributor in this country. They are choosing a different streaming service. And it's one of the reasons why you have, in different countries, you can have streaming services that only exist in that country. And that streaming service, so in the US, you have Hulu's like that. In Canada, we have something called Crave, which is kind of like that. And these local companies that only serve the domestic market, they make contracts with certain distributors only for that market. But that same distributor maybe will have a contract in a different country where that streaming service doesn't exist. They're going to make a deal with somebody else. And so insofar as there is this degree of competition, you can't really have the international version available on a singular streaming service, because it would get rid of all the domestic competition. And I think that would probably be more harmful for streaming, because you would just have a couple of big giants who can distribute internationally, and then every local variant would be killed off. And these local variants, you never know, might become the next global giant eventually, and you want to give them that room to compete. And by saying that only the ones that can distribute internationally have even the opportunity to, is kind of a barrier to competition.
And as for the chicken and the egg question, who's at fault here in the first place? You know, as a consumer, I want to have access to as much content as possible. And I'm asking myself the question, is it the distributors that, you know, are in archaic models and maybe even very long contracts with some distributors as to like when they're supposed to broadcast and who they can broadcast to? Or is it the governments that started this copyright system in the first place that is just very old and based on countries? Who's at fault here?
I wouldn't know if it's like anyone at clear fault, because the system was designed for a different time. But if anything, I would say that it is in the interest of a lot of film distributors to not update their models for the digital age, because they would get lower margins on what they're doing. They like the fact that it's complicated, because then they're in the position to bargain for their content. And so even if streaming services wanted to update digital copyright, or if there was a political will to, you would get pushback from distributors who would be in less of a position of power if this was the case. But there is some validity to it in the fact that, like, as you just said, a singular international market might be too complicated to solve. But in a place like the EU, where you do have a lot of harmonization of legislation and copyrights and stuff like that, the case for having local rights between these countries makes less sense, because everything else is already the same. So it depends on where you are. And that also affects who has the ability to do something. Because in the EU, there is that political capacity to do something. And so that makes a stronger case that, you know, get the legislators doing it. When we're talking about, you know, the United States and how they're dealing with other countries when it comes to geo-blocking, like, that's much harder, because it requires a degree of international cooperation that doesn't exist. So it depends on where you are.
And it's certainly in the interest of everyone, because, you know, if I don't have access to certain shows, I also am incentivized to get it somewhere else and to stream it without paying for content. Do you think, maybe in conclusion, that, I mean, streaming has given us the opportunity to access things very quickly, and now with, you know, even 5G technology, even as quickly as possible, that has bridged the gap of what we used to call illegal downloads when we used to use LimeWire and so on. Are you optimistic about more solutions to be found on this, or are we going to be stuck no matter what in this in this copyright fight?
It becomes a issue on what's the best way to deliver services. So there was a period when there were only a couple of streaming giants that illegal downloads dropped a lot. But now that you actually have a lot of streaming companies, and each having only less content than before because they're making different contracts than before, you do have people moving towards illegal download again, because it requires, like, oh, I need to get 20 different streaming services to get the exact same amount of content that I had a couple of years ago on only a couple. And so and I don't think this is how the market works. Like, for competition in this kind of market, it isn't you'll have 500 different players forever. Eventually, a couple of them will find their niches and everything else will be relegated to, like, the way that Shudder has specialized. We're only doing horror content in a lot of places. And it's like, oh, okay, great. So horror buffs will subscribe to that. Nobody else will. And then there's some general things. You'll find the market normalizing in that way. And right now it's a competition between which companies are able to deliver the best speed and variety of content and the best way for the consumer. And it's a process. Like, you can't say right now that we found the winner, but that complexity will weed down. And once there's clearer modes on how to deliver it the cheapest, the service will get better for you. And then that'll incentivize illegal downloading again.
And that concludes this episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow Ryan Khurana on Twitter. That's at Ryan Khurana. Khurana is Khurana. And find a policy note he also co-authored for the Consumer Choice Center under the publications page of consumerchoicecenter.org. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz. See you Thursday.
You have to learn. Just like everybody.